The King has led the nation in a two-minute silence to mark Remembrance Sunday. The Prime Minister has said today is a chance to reflect on the extraordinary courage of British Armed Forces personnel who've served in conflicts. Members of the royal family laid wreaths of red poppies at the foot of the cenotaph in central London. Our royal correspondent, Johnny Diamond, was watching.
And the King's just been handed a wreath of poppies. He's walking forward to the steps of the cenotaph. He goes up those two broad steps, leans his wreath against that block of stone, the cenotaph. Absolute silence up and down Whitehall. The vast avenue is filled with veterans, berets and medals.
UK military personnel are helping Belgium defend itself after suspected Russian drone incursions in its airspace. The new head of the UK military, Sir Richard Knighton, told the BBC that his Belgian counterpart had asked for assistance earlier this week. In an interview for Sunday with Laura Koonsberg, Sir Richard would not confirm that the incursions had been made by Russia, but said it was plausible.
It is important to be clear, though, that we don't know, and the Belgians don't yet know, the source of that those drones, but we will help them by providing our kit and capability, which has already started to deploy to help to Belgium.
More than a million people in the Philippines have been told to leave their homes as Super Typhoon Fongwan approaches. The evacuation order comes less than a week after another typhoon killed at least 200 people. The BBC says its chairman, Samir Shah, will respond to MPs tomorrow after a leaked memo raised concerns about parts of the corporation's news coverage. The document, written by a former BBC adviser, said, among other things, that Panorama had misled viewers by editing together separate sections of a speech by President Trump. Leading influenza scientists have warned the UK could be facing the worst flu season in a decade. The experts have raised concerns because the virus mutated in the middle of the summer and appears to be able to evade some of the immunity that's been built up in previous years. And the weather this afternoon, a band of showery rain will move east for most, heavy at times in the west. Clouding over but staying dry for southeast England, highs of 14 Celsius in London, 13 in Cardiff and 12 in Belfast and Edinburgh. And that's the BBC News. And whether it's 2 minutes past 12, now it's time for Private Passions with Michael Barclay.
Hugh Bonneville is one of the most familiar faces on British television and film. You might know him as the Earl of Grantham from Downton Abbey, or the long-suffering Mr. Brown in the Paddington films, or the baffled Ian Fletcher in the London Olympics sitcom 2012 and the BBC-centred sequel W1A. Hugh was captivated by acting from an early age, staging his own plays at home and even making the tickets to sell to his family. More recently, he's branched out into writing with a memoir, Playing Under the Piano, and a children's book, Rory Sparks and the Elephant in the Room, which is inspired by some of the events of his childhood. Well, you've brought music today, Hugh, by Beethoven, Strauss, Elgar, but I think you want to begin with Fauré.
Yes, and this really, I claim no musical expertise at all, so all my reactions to these choices are purely emotional. And the Pia Jesu from Fauré's Requiem was a piece that my father adored. I can remember hearing it as a child wafting up the staircase when I was in bed and he had it on his turntable. So it always takes me back to childhood.
So this wasn't under the piano, this was above the piano.
Absolutely. And my dad was a wonderful pianist right up until his final days. So the piano has featured largely in my life, but this was one that was on the record player.
Thank you.
Michael, I'm rather transfixed by you were almost conducting that as we were listening. I mean, I was transported, but you were transported in a different way. Where does it take you?
I always moved almost in a tactile way when I hear music. I can't stop myself, probably terribly irritating.
No, it's enchanting.
You know, I mean, following the phrases and especially the way that comes to that beautiful ending. It probably doesn't surprise you that that piece is so often heard at memorial services and funerals. Because, as you say, it has a transporting quality. Mm,
completely.
We heard the Pia Jesu from Gabriel Fauré's Requiem, performed by Elie Ameling, the Rotterdam Philharmonic Orchestra, conducted by Jean Fournet. Hugh Bonneville, tell me a little bit more about your early life. And rather appropriately, you were born in Paddington.
Yes, in the Lido wing. My parents were both medics. My father had trained as a doctor there, as a surgeon. And my mum had trained as a nurse. So I think one of the perks of the job was that you got George Pinker, the royal obstetrician, to deliver at St Mary's Paddington. I mean, I didn't spend any more time than I think the first day or so in Paddington, but I grew up initially in East Sheen near Richmond and then Blackheath. And that was the most vivid part of my childhood memory, in which fed into the stories in my first children's book.
Your father was a urologist, urological surgeon, but I think your mum, you discovered, had something of a career at MI6.
Yes, only when I was about 10, having brought up the three children, she said she was going to get an office job 3 days a week. So I sort of stormed off to my bedroom and slammed the door and said, what about my tea time? You know, what am I going to do? It's all right for you. And then cut forward to sort of 30 years or so, and yes, I opened the newspaper and then it said MI6 building to be sold. And I rang her and I said, that's where you used to work. That's the office, that Century House. That's opposite Lambeth North Tube. That's where we used to drop you off when you went to the office. She said, yes, dear. I said, you were a spy. And she said, no, dear, I did some filing. And anyway, I later discovered that I went actually to River House and did a lunchtime chat about Civvy Street. And one of the chaps came up to me afterwards and said, I worked with your mum. This was after she'd passed away and long after this story had become family knowledge. And I said, oh, gosh, I never knew what she did because she never spoke about it, obviously. I said, I gather she did filing. And he said, well, you could put it like that. Sort of. Anyway, it was lovely to meet someone who'd worked with her, and she was his first sort of boss, I think.
You mentioned that your father played the piano. That must have been quite a part of family life, because once people practising piano, it's almost an everyday thing, isn't it?
Oh, it certainly was. And in our house in Blackheath, there was a sort of playroom area where the piano was, and I used to listen to my dad practice before he went off to work at the hospital, and it was wonderful to hear him play because he was so good. That skill and that enjoyment that he had lasted. He died aged just as he turned 94, and he had dementia towards the end, but the last faculty that remained was his ability to play music and to enjoy music. And that's a fascinating, I think, part of the neurological makeup of the human brain, that music is such a vital part of our lives. It's an intrinsic part of our, literally our body clock, I think. It was very profoundly moving to hear him play when other elements of his life were fading, but to still hear him play Schubert and even Scott Joplin, you know, was wonderful.
Well, if you were to pick a particular piece which triggers that neurological memory of your father, I think it would be Beethoven, wouldn't it?
Oh, well, he did love Beethoven, and in fact, this particular piece that we're going to hear next was brought to my attention by an old pal of mine, Christopher Luscombe, who's now a very well-established opera director, because he said, did you know that Beethoven wrote jazz? And I went, what? What are you talking about? And he played me this piece one day, and I then, you know, showed it to my dad, and he said, oh, yes, of course, yes, and he played a little bit of it himself. So that was a bit of an eye-opener, that Beethoven had got into syncopation long before anybody else had.
And he would tell you bedtime stories, inventive ones?
Yes, I always remember the smell of the hospital, not knowing at the time what it was particularly. Of course, it was the sort of disinfectant smell of the operating theatre. But if I was still awake, he'd come up and always, you know, kneel down by the bed and ruffle my hair and tell me this bedtime story, always with the same preamble that gave him time to think of what the main meat of the story would be. But it always featured the hero, Hugh de Boo-de-Boo was his name. And I'd have lots of adventures with a squirrel, largely in Richmond Park.
Well, let's think about that as we listen to the Arietta, the second movement of Beethoven's Piano Sonata, number 32. Thank you.
I love that. And that is, suddenly goes boogie-woogie, doesn't it? It's extraordinary. I love it.
He must have been quite accomplished, your dad.
Yeah, absolutely. But I love that. It's sort of so joyous. I think it's gorgeous, that piece.
We heard the Arietta, the second movement of Beethoven's Piano Sonata No. 32 in C minor, played by Stephen Kovacevic. Hugh Bonneville, you mentioned Blackheath. Did that mean that there were other family around at that time?
Yes, well, I grew up in East Sheen, and that's where my father's family was very much rooted. And so I used to go back and stay with my grandma quite a lot. My grandma was quite an austere, very sweet-natured lady, but Presbyterian. And my dad said the only time he saw her drink alcohol was when they went to see Donald Woolfitt playing King Lear at the Old Vic, and in the interval she said, "I'll have a Dubonnet."
I think school life had one rather memorable occasion.
Oh, well, this was at my primary school in Blackheath, yes, when Billy Smart Circus used to come and pitch tent on Blackheath over the summer. And the kids from the school would come and join us in class for a month or so. And sometimes they'd come to school on an elephant, which I'm sure health and safety wouldn't allow these days. But it was great seeing an elephant with these amazingly exotic children on board arriving down our little street and in the playground. So that's been fed into my story of Rory Sparks and the elephant in the room.
You were the youngest of three children.
Yes, my brother was 8 years older and my sister 6 years older. My brother passed away suddenly in 2017, I think it was. He was 62, so very, very unexpected and a big shock for the family. We'd already lost my mum, and my father was in the early stages of dementia, so the blow was softened for him, but it's brought my sister and I closer, which has been wonderful.
But you did spend quite a bit of time by yourself.
Yes, and I think that's where my enjoyment of the dressing-up box came to the fore. Dad's national service was in the Far East and Mum had been born in Egypt. So the dressing-up box was full of jalabas and exotic costumes, so I'd spent many a happy hour dressing up in various outfits and creating my own shows because my sister being 6 years older, I was the annoying little pipsqueak. I used to write the tickets and the programmes and, you know, I was obviously the star of every show because I was the only person in it.
And I think your parents had a lodger which led you to experience acting firsthand, as it were.
Yes, there was an actor called Michael Bates, who many people will remember from our generation, from It Ain't Half Hot, Mum, and he was a fine stage actor. And there was a play called Forget Me Not Lane that was being tried out at Greenwich Theatre near us. And Michael was an old family friend of Mum and Dad's, and so he came to lodge with us. I was only about 8 or 9, I guess. So he was just the lodger, you know, he sat there at the breakfast dunking his toast into his egg, whatever. And then one night Dad says, "Do you want to come with me and pick Michael up from the theatre?" And I'd been to the theatre and I knew the concept of it, but I'd never had any direct connection. And so we crept into the back of the auditorium to watch the curtain call. And there was the final scene of the play and the audience was absolutely rapt. And then, you know, the curtain came down, lights went down, and then this applause started. And there was our lodger, you know, being part of this lineup of having shared this story with the audience. And by the next morning, he was God to me. I sat there studying him in a completely different light, that he'd held 300 or 400 people in the palm of his hand along with his co-stars, and they were telling stories in the dark. And that's really one of the most vivid memories of my childhood, of seeing the power of theatre, or the power of imagination, I suppose.
The next music has kind of stratospheric soprano line to it. What drew you to it?
Well, exactly that. That top note, I wouldn't pretend to know what note it is, but
it's top C.
Top C. Well, I mean, it's remarkable. And I remember I did a biopic documentary type thing about Christopher Wren once for, I think, BBC Two. And we were filming in St. Paul's after hours. So there was no one there apart from the film crew setting up. And so I went, took the opportunity to go and lie on the floor underneath the dome and look up. And I put this on in my headphones and it, you know, completely transported me to somewhere extremely special.
Thank you.
Gorgeous. Absolutely gorgeous.
Miserere Mei by Allegri, performed by the Choir of King's College, Cambridge, directed by Stephen Clebury. You went to Sherborne School, and was there inspiring drama there?
There was. It was, you know, very much on the periphery of the main curriculum, but it was very active. And to be honest, you know, some boys and girls from the girls' school were put in plays as detention, you know. So they, but there was also a very, you know, there were a couple of us in my year who were really passionate about drama, and there were one or two teachers who really embraced it and, again, lit the blue touch paper, really, for me.
And you joined the National Youth Theatre after that. Was that transformative?
That was a key moment. It changed everything for me, really. Here I was, finally, doing plays with kids who weren't in detention, who actually wanted to be there. And more importantly, kids from all over the country, from completely different backgrounds to my own. And that really opened my eyes on a sort of social level to how fortunate I'd been. And I felt a responsibility from then on to recognise my privilege and try and help to give back a bit. So I'm a very proud patron of the NYT now, which has broadened its reach even more so since the time I was in it.
You got a place at Corpus Christi College in Cambridge to study theology with the aim of becoming a lawyer?
Yeah, and my intention was to do my theology, which was a subject I loved, and then do a conversion course and become a lawyer. But it was in my second year that I thought maybe I'll just give acting a go and see if I can make a go of it and give myself 3 years to get my equity card. And if it doesn't work out, then I'll go and get a proper job. That was 38 years ago.
Were your parents supportive or were they appalled?
No, they were very supportive. And, again, this privileged position I was in, you know, if I often wonder if they'd said, don't be ridiculous, go and get a proper job, whether I would have had the courage to run off and, you know, join the circus. But they were very supportive and embarrassingly so. So my very first job was at Regent's Park at the Open Air Theatre. And I was understudying and holding a spear and so on, but I had one line in Romeo and Juliet, and I bumped into my godfather that summer on the street in London, and he said, oh, I gather you're playing Romeo at Regent's Park. And I said, no, I'm in Romeo at Regent's Park. I'm not playing Romeo.
Who else was in that production?
Ralph Fiennes was Romeo, and I understudied him as Lysander in Midsummer Night's Dream. And the wonderful Sarah Woodward was Juliet. And Bernard Breslau played Bottom in Midsummer Night's Dream, in one of the finest bottoms I've ever seen. He really was.
Do you believe in kind of making your own luck, making things happen in that way?
I always say when students ask me about how do you get your break, and no one in my profession owes you anything, and there's no point sitting by the phone staring at it, willing it to ring. So if you can put yourself in the path of luck, then that's better. That's different to saying bash down doors and be arrogant and demand jobs. But luck has a hugely important part to play. And you sometimes are mystified by some people who, as it were, make it, and some who... I was at drama school with way more talented people than myself who never got a break. I got a lucky break. I got a break understudying Rafe at Regent's Park, and I can trace every job back to that moment.
Did you write letters?
I did. I went to Webber Douglas Drama School for a postgrad year, and I just did the maths. I thought, if I don't start writing letters to producers and casting directors and theatres until the summer, I'll be one of several thousand people emerging from drama school. So I started writing on day one. I arrived at drama school and I wrote about 200 letters, which in those days, I did manage to photocopy them, but topped and tailed them by hand. But I think I wrote 200 letters and got two auditions out of it, and one of them was for Regent's Park because I'd written off-season and I got lucky and the letter landed on the artistic director's desk on a day when he was in a good mood and thought I need some, you know, new blood for the next season. So that was that.
In 1991, you joined the Royal Shakespeare Company, starring as Laertes in Hamlet alongside Kenneth Branagh. Mm. Was that particularly memorable?
Hugely. I look back on it now and realise what a turning point it was, really. I loved the Royal Shakespeare Company. At the time, Adrian Noble, it was his first year, and I did four plays in The Swan, and then latterly did Ken Branagh's, I think, third iteration of Hamlet. And, of course, that was a huge hit, you know, queues round the block, and working with Ken, who was this dynamo of energy, and certainly the fastest Hamlet I've ever seen. I remember that we got to... I mean, he was a remarkable man. At the time, he'd just finished editing his radio version of Romeo and Juliet. He was putting the finishing touches to a movie, which I'm sure we'll talk about, and was in pre-production for his film of Frankenstein. and doing a full-length Hamlet. I think we cut one line. And I remember doing the first preview, and suddenly he was like a greyhound in the slips. He just took off and left me and all the others behind. I had no idea it was that the performance was suddenly going to be on this new level. And I remember going to him in the interval and knocking on his door and saying, "You bastard, what are you doing? You know, you could have warned us." Because it was a whole new... He'd really changed up a gear, and it was absolutely mesmeric to watch. Every night I'd hear lines afresh that I'd never... You know, he new minted phrases that have become hackneyed. And I mean, everybody's got their own take on Hamlet, and you know, some are too light, some are too dark, some, you know, whatever. But for me, this was Quicksilver. His ability with his dexterity with language was wonderful to behold. But the film he was editing at the time that we were doing Hamlet was Much Ado. And I remember he took me to a screening. He wanted to see one of the final versions of it on a big screen and see the grading and all that. And so we went over to Leamington Spa, and as it was screened for a matinee before we did the evening show of Hamlet, and this beautiful, beautiful film unfurled before me. And again, my admiration for him went up another notch, because I thought it was a beautifully executed film. And the music, Patrick Doyle's music, lifts it to, as all music can do, lifts it to another level. I mean, that piece is, whatever, 4:20, I think, it says here. But as it was playing, I was immediately transported back to that opening sequence in the film, which, if I urge anyone to watch it, even if you don't enjoy Shakespeare, just watch that opening sequence, because it is the perfect marriage of cinematography and music. The martial element versus the domestic, as these heroes of the war come home and all the people at home are preparing for their arrival, and the girls are powdering their, you know, their chests with anticipation of these butch men coming over the horizon. So it's full of testosterone and energy and passion for life coming back to some degree of normality, or so we think. It's beautiful music. And I remember meeting Patrick Doyle some years later and rather fanboying over this piece. And I said, how on earth did you compose that? But he said, I was really stuck on how to introduce that. You see these horses coming over the horizon of these, you know, these butch military heroes coming back. And he said, I was really stuck on finding it. And I think he was sitting at a lake house somewhere in Scotland and looking out at the lake one day and thinking, how on earth? And the wind was up. And then he saw these seahorses begin to rise and fall on the water. He said, oh, that's it. Da-da-da-da-da-da. And he said, I suddenly found the rhythm of the galloping hooves as they come over the horizon. It gives me a tingle down my spine.
It's a very splendid overture, I must say, from the original soundtrack of Much Ado About Nothing by Patrick Doyle, performed by the City of Prague Philharmonic Orchestra and conducted by David Snell. You're probably best known, Hugh, around the world as Lord Grantham on Downton Abbey. How did that come about?
I was doing a film with Julian Fellowes, and we were filming in his garden in Dorchester, a sequence I can remember vividly. And there were cameras were setting up, and I asked him, this was a film called From Time to Time, which starred the late Maggie Smith and, as it turned out, half the cast of the future Downton Abbey. And I asked him in between setups one day, what else have you got on the burner? As your, you know, writers always have several things on the go. And he started describing two or three projects. And the one he mentioned, particularly that stuck with me, he said, well, I'm revisiting the territory of Gosford Park, and it's set in this country house before the First World War, and it starts with the sinking of the Titanic, and that sort of triggers a whole sequence of events. And I said, well, that's interesting. He said, well, actually, you know, there's, you know, a part you, I'm sure, could play. I said, well, when it's ready, would you send it to me? And so 10 months later, when the whole thing was sort of green lit, it came my way, and I couldn't put down the first episode. This was before any of it was cast, and these characters were so vivid, and the story was so soap-like in its forward momentum. Short scenes, vivid characters, you wanted to know what happened next, and I got to the end of episode one, and, you know, I was tantalised, you know, I was hooked. And as Julian said, you know, in the world of sort of long-running dramas, there are very few precincts, as they're known, where you can legitimately get a cross-section of society. One is hospitals, one is the cop shop, and he said the other one was the country house, because there, if you fully investigate it, if you slice it open, you've got every strata of society existing, coexisting.
The TV series was adapted for film, and the third in the trilogy, Downton Abbey, the grand finale, was released last month. It must have been very poignant that it was filming after the death of Dame Maggie Smith, who, after all, played your mother.
Well, the character of Violet Crawley passed away in the second film. We actually completed filming of the third film without her, and then she passed away in real life a few months after we finished filming. So while her character was definitely hanging over the third film, and she's referred to a lot, it was particularly poignant after we'd finished filming that she then passed away. And so the final film really has been a tribute to her, and explicitly so.
Was she as formidable in real life as she could appear on screen when she wanted to?
Completely. No, I always say that I was intimidated on day one of filming and intimidated on the last day I had with her, but also with a huge respect and affection for her. Bearing in mind, she was in her, I think, late 70s when she took on the role, but she was addicted to acting. It was in her blood and it was in every vein of her, and passionate about it. And she was hardest on herself. And if she was, you know, having an off day, she'd be cross with herself that she wasn't quite on it. But then there'd be one take where she would just strike the seam and the gold would flow. She was remarkable. And it was a privilege to spend that length of time with her, the good days and bad days. And on the good days, there was no one finer to work with.
Well, perhaps as we listen to the theme from Downton Abbey, we could think of Maggie Smith.
Yeah.
Thank you.
I really heard there for the first time, or more vividly than usual, the pulse of the train. Because the opening episode of the first season was this train journey of Mr. Bates coming towards Downton Abbey and the rise and fall of the telegraph wires as we see this message coming from who knows where to the castle and being delivered to Lord Grantham saying that the Titanic has gone down. And again, talking to John Lund, the composer, about how he created that now iconic opening title music, he said it was watching the rise and fall of the telegraph wires and the pulse of the train underneath. So I'm fascinated by where people draw inspiration from and when it works, how it lands.
The theme from Downton Abbey, composed, as you've said, by John Lunn and performed by the City of Prague Philharmonic Orchestra, conducted by James Fitzpatrick. When you were young, you probably had to deal with rejection from auditions sometimes, which must be very difficult. But presumably you don't have to do auditions so much now because people know what they want. Or do they still sometimes ask you to go and read?
Well, and I love doing that. I think the absolute scourge of my industry now is this thing called the self-tape, which is where you are expected to audition and deliver a superb performance or at least read the director's mind on your own in a bedroom somewhere with a camera facing you. I think it's disgraceful. It's been on the rise for, 10, 15 years or so, and I get it. It means that, in theory, casting directors can have a much broader net because you're not seeing everybody in person. But I think, absolutely, if you do begin to cast people that way, at least when it comes to the second or third round, you get to see them in person. I worked with a few directors recently who said it's been a huge detriment to their casting process not to be able to meet people in person, because you soon get an idea of whether you're going to have a rapport, whether the actor will take direction or not. But to answer your question, yes, I love getting in a room with a director and working through a scene and seeing whether we're going to get on. It sometimes happens. And I did a film with George Clooney about 10, 12 years ago called The Monuments Men. And then
about the paintings.
It was about the art that had been spirited away by the Germans, and a true story of the unsung heroes of the art world who went in as the troops were advancing through Europe to try and rescue pieces of art and make sure that they got back to where they came from. And then a couple of years ago, when I was writing my memoir, my agent said, "This is a bit awkward, but I've had a message from George Clooney's office. Would you go on tape for a new film he's producing?" And she said, "You shouldn't have to do this because you've worked with him." I said, "Yes, we did spend several weeks together, and he does know my work. But I'm writing a book, and it would be a good chapter in the book." And so I did put myself on tape because one of the questions was, "Please tell us a bit about yourself and what other work you've done." So I said, "Hello, my name's Hugh Bonneville, and I've been in shows like Downton Abbey and the Paddington films, and actually a film called The Monuments Men, which you directed. Anyway, here's my audition for." Anyway, I didn't get the part.
One of your very memorable roles, Hugh, was Ian Fletcher in the highly acclaimed mockumentary 2012, where he was head of the Olympic Deliverance Commission. That really hit a chord with people, didn't it?
It did, and let's face it, that period, I think there was a real sense of, oh my gosh, are we going to make a right pickle of this? It turned out to be, in my feeling anyway, a magnificent experience. And in the lottery, I got tickets for what became Super Saturday and saw those three gold medals coming our way. And I remember screaming my voice out to the extent that when we filmed Downton Abbey on the Monday, I had to revoice all my scenes because my voice was so hoarse. But that was a very memorable experience. So therefore, Ian Fletcher, the character who'd been trying to navigate this fictional task force through to success under the aegis of Sebastian Coe's leadership. And Sebastian was, I have to say, Lord Coe was a great sport and was in the show. So no one could really accuse us of trying to take the mick out of him or his team. As with W1A, it was about the nature of committees and trying to get your team to do things when you have a hunch they won't. And after the success of Ian Fletcher organising the Olympics, he then was parachuted into the BBC as head of values. We did several episodes based in this building. And I've just finished filming a show called 2026, where Ian Fletcher is now working for a very large multinational football organisation, organising a huge world tournament in 2026. I think we're allowed to say the word World Cup once per episode, and we can't mention FIFA, bleeped. But I've been parachuted in there as head of integrity. And as you know, the Football World Cup next year is being shared between Mexico, Canada and USA. So it sort of writes itself.
You've said that W1A
had some of the most difficult things you've had to do. Was that because it was written rather than improvised?
Absolutely. I think that often it's put in the same realm as that wonderful show by Amanda Iannucci, The Thick of It. And as I understand it, Amanda and his team write the script and they film that, and then they'll do one or two takes which are improvised. So you get this blend of the two styles. Whereas John Morton, who writes and directs all these iterations of the journey that Ian Fletcher's been on, every word is scripted, every um and er. So the knack is to make it sound natural and improvised, but actually it's very orchestral. I always compare it to music because the scenes rattle along at a particular pace, and these interjections of ums and ers and wells and brilliant yes, no, and yes, no really is different to really no, yes. But how do you learn that when most of the lines don't really make any sense? It's incredibly hard. And we, instead of, you know, sitting there doing the crossword in between setups, we're all there running the lines, trying to get the rhythm right. Because when it doesn't land in the right way, it's like a string breaking on a violin. It suddenly goes ping and it doesn't sound as good. So we're always there trying to make it go at the right pace and feel natural, even though it's very, very much not natural and it's actually all constructed, so it's exhausting.
One of the wonderful Four Last Songs by Strauss next.
Yes, I spent the summer of 2005 in Mallorca making this film called Four Last Songs with Stanley Tucci and Rhys Ivans. Rhys Ivans and I playing brothers, which is slightly unlikely, but it was largely improvised, or certainly the rehearsals were improvised, and then the script was formed, and then we shot it, and it became an extraordinary summer. I mean, the film didn't trouble the box office very much, but the music, obviously, was the thematic background. And I think there's one scene where Rhys and I play it on a gramophone. I can't remember if it's September, but September's the one that has resonated with me, and they're beautiful pieces.
Thank you.
September from the Four Last Songs by Richard Strauss, performed by Lisa Davidson and the Philharmonia Orchestra, conducted by Esa-Pekka Salonen. That's very much a kind of yearning music about loss and regret in Strauss's life. It was the loss of a way of life, actually, in Vienna at that time. But you too, Hugh Bonneville, had your fair share of grief, haven't you? You lost your mum suddenly, as you said, in 2015. And then 2 years later, your brother Nigel also died. And so do you find solace in music when you think about things like that?
I do, increasingly. And grief is obviously part of the human tapestry. And we've all been through it or will experience it. And just so to lose my mother and then my brother very suddenly was a very strange experience, but it prepared me then to look after or be around Dad as he faded. So I look back now, obviously, with great affection and gratitude for those three lives that were very close to me. And someone just wrote to me after my mum's death, describing it like the waves of grief being like waves on a seashore, that they can crash in one day and then the next day they'll come in as a little ripple. And sometimes the things that, you know, the memories you have will suddenly provoke laughter, and yet the same memory, you know, a few days later could provoke enormous pain and tears. Mm. It's fascinating, grief. I mean, I wouldn't don't recommend it to everybody, but it's inevitable.
You describe your dad as disappearing into the fog. My father too got dementia, so I know exactly what you mean. And that's a kind of almost worse sort of loss, isn't it? Because people lose their dignity, and you see them there but not there.
Yes, but I think it's harder for the carer, for the griever. Yeah. We were very, very fortunate. My father had a very sort of benign character by nature. And while there were bits of Alzheimer's, which I think can really be the source of aggressive behaviour and that sort of thing, we were very lucky. He was a gent to the end, he really was, and gentle and kind. But yes, it's those glimpses. When you think all is lost and I no longer know him, then there'll be something, there'll be some glimmer. Be it playing a piece of music or, in my case, reading Kipling to him, I could just see this spark, because Kipling was his favourite author, and I could see this spark of recognition coming through.
Did you find a degree of catharsis in writing your memoir?
Hugely, yes, because I started it while my father was still alive. He'd passed away by the end, and I write a bit about that. I hadn't intended to, really. I'd intended to write a string of, you know, showbiz stories, but actually, it's funny when you sit down and start reflecting on things. I suppose it became a love letter to my parents, really. The more I wrote, the more I realised what influences they'd had on me constructively in terms of my enjoyment of the arts and my passion for theatre, particularly.
The next piece of music might epitomise aspects of grief, and I wonder whether you listened to it when you were writing.
It certainly was on the playlist. I mean, this piece is so evocative, and I've got more than one friend who said this is playing at my funeral. I think I would probably not want to leave my congregation weeping buckets, but it does seem to capture the tones of grief.
The Adagio for Strings by Samuel Barber, performed by the Royal Scottish National Orchestra, conducted by Marin Alsop. On a completely different tack, Hugh, you're no stranger to children's stories, but I wonder what inspired you to write them yourself?
It actually came about from my literary agent. When I delivered my manuscript for my memoir, the commission had been for 100,000 words, so I thought they'd be thrilled that I'd written 165,000. They were getting nearly two for the price of one. And then my editor said, oh, God, we're going to have to cut it down. And I said, why? He said, well, look, I'm enjoying it, but I'm on page 100 and you're still only eight. Is there any chance of moving the narrative forward a bit? And I'd realised that I'd written a huge amount about my childhood, particularly this era in Blackheath. And so I cut all that out. And it was one of my agent's colleagues who then subsequently said, what about writing a children's book? And I said, absolutely not. You know, I've got no wizards or chocolate factories in my memory bank. And I said, why do you think I should write a children's book? And she said, well, in your book, was it true that Billy Smart Circus, the children used to come to school on an elephant? And I said, yeah, completely true. And she said, well, is it also true that you dug a grave for your sister Claire because you thought it was time that she, you know, left the earth? And I said, completely. She said, well, there's, you know, there are the ingredients. So it really stemmed from there. And I did say, look, this is going to be very dull compared to modern children's literature because there are no screens, no no phones, no wizards and no time travel. And it's just, you know, this lad's life. And she said, I think that's probably quite a nice antidote to some of the other books that are out there. So I then bumped into an old friend of mine. We grew up in the same street. And he then provided a few memories for us. And so hence the world of Rory Sparks has begun. And I'm going to write three books overall.
Of course, you've played Roald Dahl, but perhaps even more memorably, Mr. Brown in all three Paddington movies written by Michael Bond. You knew him.
Well, I did briefly towards the end of his life. He was very present, actually, on the first film. And David Heyman, the producer, and Paul King, the director-writer, and Rosie Ellison, the producer, had all taken great pains to make sure that Michael was happy with what was happening.
Because he was quite protective about what happened to Paddington.
Quite rightly so. And yes, that IP, as they call it, was very fiercely protected. But Michael, I remember the phrase was that he saw the first cut of the film and said, I came, I saw, I was conquered.
What do you think lies at the heart of the success of Paddington, which after all now goes through almost every household right up to Buckingham Palace?
I think the key element, when I sort of try and scrutinise what it is, I think we've all been Paddington. We've all been a stranger in a new school, in a new town, in a new country. And we've all needed that hand of friendship that the Browns offer, that place of compassion, that sense of home. And in fact, all three stories explore the notion of home, really, what it means to be home and how do you define it. And I think we can all relate to that.
Do you think drama has the power to shape culture?
I think it has the power to reflect culture and to nudge the dial in the direction of a place that could be better. I don't think it ever claimed to change society. Having said that, you know, occasionally something flashes through, like the drama about Mr. Bates and the post office.
The post office, yeah.
Actually, you know, that story had been bubbling away for a decade, and yet it hadn't really hit home until that. And that actually changed government. That actually made government sit up and do something rapidly. And the poor people who have been a victim of that utterly disgraceful behaviour and conduct by the post office will never recover, however much cash you throw at it. And so that sort of injustice drama can highlight, you know, occasionally, but it's very rare. And I would never make any claim, as I think it was Clint Eastwood who said, if you want to send a message, use FedEx.
It's Elgar next.
Yes, I've always loved the Enigma Variations. This was played to me, I can remember, even at junior school. But this particular version, I was on tour with a play with Frank Finlay in 1995, I guess. It was the early days of mobile phones, and I was an early adopter, and I had my Mercury one-to-one phone, I remember, and I was walking up into the Malvern Hills, and my friend Tom Hollander rang, and we were having a chat, and he said, where are you? I said, oh, I'm in Elgar country. And he said, hold on. And he went and put on Nimrod. So I stood on the top of the Malvern Hills listening to Nimrod on my mobile phone. Thank you.
Nimrod by Elgar from the Enigma Variations, performed by the City of Birmingham Symphony Orchestra, conducted by Simon Rattle. You always said you thought of acting as a rather daft profession, but you obviously take it incredibly seriously. And after 30 years, do you feel that you've sort of achieved some of the goals you set yourself at the beginning?
Well, my initial goals were to get my equity card, which in those days you had to have. It was the catch-22 of being an actor. You couldn't act without an equity card, and you couldn't get an equity card without a job. So I gave myself 3 years to get that. And then Chichester was my local theatre, and so I gave myself 5 years to do a job there and then 10 years to get to the Royal Shakespeare Company. I actually got those two the wrong way round in the end. But so those were my goals. So I did achieve those goals, and I cherish each of those experiences. Now I suppose my goals are just to keep working. I think any actor who says, oh, yes, I've achieved everything, is a bit of a fibber. I think really acting is about keeping working and keep exploring the stories in the dark room. You know, I'm very lucky to keep working.
Your final piece has a geographical importance to you, I think.
Well, yes, this is by my dear friend Damien Montagu, who has been a neighbour for many years. And it's called The South Downs Way. I lived for a long time in the lee of the South Downs, really. And Damien loves the South Downs Way as much as I do. I've walked it once and want to do it again. But he's a composer by profession, and he'd written this suite of music and asked me to read some words over the top of it. And that became this piece called Inner South Downs Way. And this suite has a really elegant, beautiful piece in the middle of it called The Path Towards Tomorrow, which a number of people subsequently had heard on the radio and asked if they could use it at their wedding. So it strikes a chord seemingly with all sorts of people.
Well, it only remains for me to thank you very much indeed, Hugh Bonneville.
Well, thank you, yes. It's been a pleasure to chat to you, Michael. And I suppose until this conversation, I hadn't realised how much music has impacted my life, so I'm very grateful for it. Thank you.
Path Towards Tomorrow from Inner South Downs Way, composed by Damien Montague and performed by the Tippett Quartet, the final choice of Michael Barclay's guest on Private Passions, the actor Hugh Bonneville. The programme was produced by Claire Walker. And next week, Michael's guest will be the Albanian academic and author, Professor Leah Upi. In a few moments, Sarah Moore-Peach embarks on a musical journey from boozy taverns to snowy wastes towards the second movement of Schubert's Piano Trio No. 2 in E-flat, one of the composer's final works.
Earlier, with me, Jules Holland, on BBC Radio 3. Every Saturday lunchtime, I share my passion for classical music and its connection with jazz and blues. I play some of my favourite music and receive a visit from some amazing and fascinating guests.
Gregory Porter.
It's Katie Tunstall.
The wonderful Lang Lang.
Emily Sande.
Over the past few years, I've started to listen to orchestral pieces. You can go places and express emotions beyond what I think is possible with piano music.
Earlier, with me, Jules Holland, Saturday afternoons from 12. Listen on Radio 3 and whenever you like on BBC Sounds.
Later this afternoon at 3, Choral Evensong comes from the Chapel of the Old Royal Navy College Greenwich in London with the Trinity Laban Chapel Choir with music for the Season of Remembrance. But first on Radio 3, Sarah Moore-Peach plots a musical course from the taverns of Vienna to the snowy wastes of Scandinavia.
Hello and welcome to BBC Radio 3's Music Map. Franz Schubert is dying. This is one of the last pieces he wrote before he passed away at the age of just 31. A piano trio, the slow movement of which sounds a bit like a funeral march. And this is our destination piece for today's music map. We'll hear this movement for piano trio at the end of the show. And on our journey there, we'll meet other composers who died young, explore the sounds of the city where Schubert made his home, and follow threads of funeral marches across the ages. But let's begin by plotting this piece in terms of the instruments Schubert was writing for: violin, cello, and piano. In the 18th century, if you combined those three instruments, you weren't writing a trio at all, you were making a violin sonata. So here's one by Corelli. Thank you.